And now, stay tuned for another episode of the Traumatic States of America.
Welcome to the Traumatic States of America. Our main goal is to begin to heal some of the trauma we have suffered, both individually and collectively. I am your host, Dr. Lori Hood, and I will be talking with people from all walks of life who have suffered trauma in its myriad forms. Military veterans, attorneys, first responders, football players, stay-at-home moms, and many more. We will hear how trauma has not only affected them, but their families and communities, as we take an in-depth look at what science has to offer and what can be done to prevent, mitigate, and help recover from trauma. Hello, everyone, and it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Mike Lewis back for the second part of this episode. We talked for over 2 hours, and if you haven't heard the first part, please do listen to it. Mike is a fantastic guy. He's doing so much to help firefighter paramedics like himself, but also just husbands and wives and people who have PTSD, PTSI, and so it's really my pleasure to welcome him back.
I'm sure people are wondering, you know, how I got in the situation that I'm in. My whole life started with a baseball in my hand. I threw a baseball before I could crawl. I threw a baseball before I could walk. So I spent a lot of time either thinking about baseball, playing baseball, or watching baseball. 24/7 of my life was baseball. And I wanted to be on TV. I wanted to go play pro ball. And I knew that it was going to take a lot of hard work. So when I was like 5 or 6 years old, I made that determination to go on and play at the collegiate level, to play the pro level, you know, and do whatever I can to go be on TV.
Can I stop for just a second? I'm hearing this whole family behind you. I'm hearing little kids and like there's a, so I'm sorry to interrupt you, but see, like,
oh, you're good.
But this is, so I think a lot of us who are citizens think that you guys are your job. Like you're like, you're always a firefighter, or you're always an LEO, or you're always a whatever you want, paramedic, but you know, you're real people and you have the same family, home, you know, joys, yep, and stressors and demands and everything on top of what you do. So I love it. And it's such a joy to hear those little voices, but.
So we'll kind of sidebar into that. So,
yeah.
I have a 14 year old son. I got an 8 year old daughter that just had a birthday last Saturday. Nice. And then I also have a 2 year old son that will be 3 in August.
Who we're hearing now, right?
Yep. So they want to go. They know the camper's out at the lake, and they know that here before too long we'll be out at the campsite camping.
Oh, good for you.
It's kind of just our way of, you know, not being a paramedic or not being a firefighter. You know, they're right. Just kind of just relaxing.
So husband and dad.
Yep. So they're getting a little anxious, but that's all right.
It's awesome.
But kind of back into the baseball thing, you know, that's all I ever wanted to do. And I knew that it was going to take hard work because I wasn't the biggest guy. I wasn't the strongest guy. I wasn't the fastest guy. But my mentality was, I'm going to be the best. So I had one of the guys that was coaching me, he literally pulled me aside and was like, let's go do this. So I was like, okay. So I bought into him and I trusted him with everything that I had. And I did everything to a T that he told me to do. So I finally started throwing the ball hard. I started hitting the ball further. I started to do all this. Everything started to click. And so I was actually, we were playing summer baseball up in Topeka, I believe. I don't remember any of, well, I don't remember all of it. I remember bits and pieces of it. And I had a bunch of professional teams there to watch me pitch, you know, and to watch me play.
And you were how old?
And I was 17.
Wow. Okay.
So, I signed a full ride college scholarship to Allen County Community College as a first baseman and as a pitcher. So my part one of my goals and my dreams, it was coming true. You know, so then we went to Topeka and my ex-girlfriend came up, well, ex now, obviously, but she came up there and told me that she was going to break up with me because I was moving away to college and I was chasing this crazy ass baseball dream.
Not the woman you want for your spouse. I'll just say point blank. Like, that's just not right? The person you want on your team as a life partner.
Nope. And I, you know, I was 17. I was young and dumb. And I'm like, oh, okay. I was like, no, I don't need this in my life. So I told her to leave. And so she went to go leave. And she calls me and she's like, hey, my phone is dead or my car's dead. So my dad, you know, he's like, hey, we can go jump her and she can just go on her merry way. I'm like, okay. So my dad had his end of the jumper cable hooked up to the live battery. And I don't remember any of this. It's all hearsay. So I hooked my end up to that dead battery. And that's when it got me. And I got, you know, I was shocked by that car battery. And it hit my steel toe boots and then blew out of my chest.
I did not know that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, not a lot of people know. So there's a handful of people that know that. Well, now the entire world knows it.
Oh my gosh.
So I was like, oh. So, you know, I was rushed. I woke up in the emergency room and I had no clue where I was. I had no clue what happened. All I know is I had a bunch of burn dressings on me.
Jeez.
And my fingers and my toes were numb. And all I could think about was, I have to pitch tomorrow because I got the Texas Rangers there. I got the Atlanta Braves there. I got the Chicago Cubs there. Like, I have a bunch of teams here that are expecting to see me pitch.
Oh, my God.
So the ER physician there in Topeka, he's like, you're not playing. And I was like, yes, I am. So he told my parents, if he can get released by his cardiologist, that I will sign off his release and he can play. Because I was in a big tournament. And, you know, they checked all that. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, my parents rushed me back down to Wichita. And I got cleared by my cardiologist. But he gave me very strict limitations.
Okay.
Well, as what you know by me,
you didn't listen to them.
Nope. So we went down and started the process of getting cleared to go play baseball. So he told me, all right, I'm going to clear it, but you have to come back. So I went up and I threw the best game of my life.
Wow.
Out of the 27 hitters I faced, I struck out 20 of them. And I finally threw the ball over 95 miles an hour.
Wow.
So the guy that I was coaching, or the guy that was coaching me, he's like, well, we just need to shock you some more times. So the running joke, you know, that was, I'm 34 now, so 17 years ago, my nickname has been Shock. So
that's perfect. Just shock him more.
Yep. So then I went back and I did not get cleared to go to college because I was supposed to go to Allen County that August. I think that took place in July. I'm not 100% sure.
So wait, why not?
Because I had a bad heart and they were expecting to do open heart surgery.
Oh my gosh.
So, to fix the damage. So I was sitting there, I was like, so I'm 17, I'm fixing to have open heart surgery and I cannot play the game I've played for 15 years. So you can just imagine where my mind went. And, you know, I knew nothing about the trauma. I knew nothing about any of that. But I was determined. By December, I was going to go play college ball somewhere.
Yeah.
So I made my cardiologist book, you know, every single day I was in his office with my mom, going through stress tests, trying to get my heart stronger and trying to, figure out the motions that I could do, right. Because I'm a right-handed pitcher and I could not take my right palm and touch my left elbow at my side without it just absolutely killing me.
Wow.
So we hit the end of November-ish. And he's like, okay, I think you're cleared to go, but I want to see you throw first.
Okay.
And I'm like, deal. I haven't touched a baseball in 4 months. Like, this is killing me. So I did. And I was still throwing upper 80s, lower 90s. And he asked me about the pain. And, you know us. I was like, we're fine. Right. Everything's good.
Right. And no pain.
So then he's like, okay, you are cleared to go. So I left and I signed with Kansas City, Kansas Community College.
Okay.
And I got signed as a first baseman. Mm-hmm. And then in an inter-squad game, my third baseman, and I'm still pissed at him to this day, he overthrew me and I couldn't reach it. So I ran to the fence, I picked it up, and I threw the ball across the diamond at 95.
Woo.
So they moved me to become strictly a pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the journey began. I met one of my closest friends up there. Mm-hmm. Her name is Heidi. And she turned into a sister of mine. That's just how close we got. I met her in the training room. And so she came down July 5th of 2007. And this is where it all started. So we were out there, having a good time, and she was not drinking at all. She went inside and was actually trying to sleep. But then she came out and she asked if she could ride my four-wheeler. So I taught her how to ride my four-wheeler and I showed her how to do that. And mm-hmm. she went off, out on my track and all that. And she ended up getting lost and she drove off a bridge and it was a 17-foot bridge and she drove off and landed on a T-post on her forehead.
Oh my gosh.
And so she was gone for a while and we couldn't hear her.
Oh my gosh.
So obviously we started getting worried and worked up. And so when you get to the railroad tracks, you can either go left or you can go right. Okay. And it was about 10:30 at night. So it was dark and the gut instinct was we're turning right. And we found her and, I saw my four-wheeler headlight in the water.
Oh my.
And it was flipped upside down. And to this day, I cannot tell you how we got in the water, but we did. We rolled her over and I started to I had no clue about, mouth to mouth or anything like that because I was not in EMS. And so I started to breathe for her and we called the fire department and we landed a helicopter in my aunt's front yard and flew her out.
Wow.
So, my buddy and I got back to my dad's house and we're trying to shower because we're just covered in blood. And he comes in and, and I didn't know Heidi's mom at all. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I didn't know Heidi's last name, I knew her last name, but her mom's last name is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there, my dad's trying to call her, call some family of hers. And we had no clue who her family was. And, so my dad comes in and we're trying to get all the blood off of us. And he said, hey, the hospital just called. We need to get to the hospital now because she's not going to make it. So we hurry up, dry off, throw clothes on, and we get to the hospital. And they come out and said, the likelihood of her surviving is slim to none. So I made it a point where I was going to stay at the hospital the entire time with her. They said that she would never walk, talk ever again.
Right.
Well, day 183, I walked her out of the hospital. We were walking out hand in hand, that we did it.
Yeah.
And so I told her, I broke the news to her. And I was like, hey, I'm going to go to Arkansas and I'm going to go play baseball. And, she was all excited and all that. And, so I got an offer from, Hardy University, because I went down there and started to play, I was going to go down there and I was going to be a first baseman and a pitcher. And I ended up, staying home because my grandma got real sick. So I stayed here because, you know, my grandma was my best friend. And so I signed with Friends University out of Wichita as a pitcher. So I stayed there and I still kept getting the professional recruits. So I checked off goal one of getting to be a college baseball player. And then I checked off number two by going to a 4-year school. Mm-hmm. And then the last hurdle was to go pro.
Right.
So I knew that I could do it because I was still throwing the ball hard. And then I met my now wife, when I was going to Friends. And, so it was May 9th of 2010, or May 8th, sorry, the day before graduation. I just signed my professional contract with the Atlanta Braves.
Wow.
To get drafted. I was going to be in the sixth
Very
round.
Very real. Right. Wow. Now
it's real.
Right. You know,
just the pure enjoyment in my mom's face was phenomenal. Because I told her, I said, Mom, I did it.
You did it.
So we had my professional contract. Everything was good. And then on that one day, you know, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, she was sitting with my mom, and I blew out my elbow in the seventh inning right before they brought the closer in. So I knew it was done, and I knew it was over.
Your career was over.
But I didn't know everything.
Just like that?
Just like that. So the NCAA, they wouldn't pay for the surgery because I was under a professional contract. Well, then the MLB wouldn't pay for it because I was still a collegiate athlete.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so there was a pissing back and forth match, and it was just, so I couldn't throw. I couldn't do the surgery. And, you know, all the surgeons that I talked to, they're like, just rehab. You don't need surgery. It's still held on by a strand. We can just get that strand nice and strong.
Okay.
Well, I couldn't throw, so I gave that up. So I kind of reverted back to when Heidi got in her accident and, you know, saw that, you know, what the fire department did, what the paramedics did, what the flight medics and nurses did. And I was like, I want to do that.
You know, yeah. Can I stop you for a second, though? Because I'm noticing something. So you have been this incredibly determined. So you had a whole life plan that was taken away in a second.
Yep.
But before that, you had overcome incredible odds. You'd helped her overcome incredible odds. Like you are, I mean, I'm getting to know you now. Like you just don't give up. But
well, you can't. There's no option.
Right. But okay, I'm going to ask something kind of tender, and we don't have to put this on the podcast, but I'm going to warn you, it's a little bit pushy.
Okay.
So you're this guy, this is who you are, but with the PTSI symptoms, you got there where you were willing to not continue. What's the difference?
So I didn't want to be seen as a failure. I didn't want my...
Something you couldn't overcome by yourself, or was it that?
Right.
So it's helpless.
Right,
you felt helpless to be able to, you felt like you couldn't do it on your own. And was it a helplessness, or was it a, I just will never do it? Or what was the difference in your mind?
It was the fact I didn't want to let everybody down.
Wow.
You know, I didn't want to let, you know, my, for lack of better words, my team down. You know, so my coworkers and my family, you know, I didn't want to let them down.
Okay, so when, but I just want to, and I'm gonna. We talked about this before the podcast, so I don't want everybody to think I'm just a jerk. And we can always edit this out. But I think you, this is part of your, like this is part of who you are in terms of teaching other people. So, and I'm guessing. So tell me if I'm right or wrong. But the thought that okay, I blew my elbow out, I can no longer play baseball. I'm not letting anybody down because it's obvious that I can't play baseball. That was okay. And you were able to definitely be resilient and overcome that and completely switch gears and change careers, right?
Right.
So when you had...
Because I still had the game of baseball because I was able to still coach.
Okay. But you didn't feel like you were letting anybody down.
No, because I was still able to step on that diamond.
But you could have done the same thing. You could have been diagnosed with PTSI and still been a mentor, or, you know, helped. You could have gone into a training career. You could do what I do. But something, I'm trying to get to the stigma. I'm trying to get to the really deep stuff. And I know you can. So there was something about the PTSI that was like, this is unacceptable, or people are going to think I'm letting them down. I feel like it's seen as not real. We're like, your elbow blows out, it's real. Everybody gets it. But
right.
So I'm trying to get this from you, because I think you have this resilience that is so clear, but yet even you were like, yeah, like, can't go on at one point, right?
Well, it's the fact that, you know, like you just said, you can see the elbow go out.
Right.
You can tell that I can no longer throw over 90. You can, but for me, it was still the fact that I'm still on the dirt. I'm still on the diamond. I'm still able to coach, but you can see that I can no longer throw. Now, to revert to the PTSI, people can't see that.
Right.
People just see the outlash and, you know, the tears, you know, and because people have seen me cry for sure. You know, and it's the mental swings that people see, and they're like, why are you doing that? Why are you being an asshole?
Right.
You know, and, oh, you can't have that because it's fake. And I've been told that by people I work with.
Wow.
You know, and so that's kind of why I went into that dark, deep corner.
Right.
And there was no other way out. I'm like, well, fuck, you can't, sorry for my language, but, you know, you can't see that. But I see it. This is real.
No, you feel it. You live it.
I feel it. Like, I can show you my heart rate at 170 beats a minute.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
My palms are pouring sweat.
Yep. And then you're taken off the mound, too. Like, so that's leadership betrayal, right? In lots of places. Absolutely. In our country, leadership betrayal. So then, not only are you not, is it not sort of a given that you're injured because it's not visible, and you're not, somehow we don't think that it's tied to, like, and I get that. My reaction's same thing. We're like completely wacky, and they didn't connect for other people to the PTSI, right? They just didn't. Like,
right.
I was irritable, or I was really teary or whatever, and they couldn't connect it. And I couldn't either, in all fairness. But then, so with the baseball thing, you were still on the mound. You were still on the dirt, right? But oftentimes,
right, I was still there.
Yeah, they take you out of it then. So you can't even prove that, yes, I can get through this. Is that it?
Right. You know, and it's kind of the same concept, you know, and after that dark day in December where that gun didn't go off, something about that, like, switched my entire mind where it's like, this is not going to break me.
Yeah.
Like, I went back to that resiliency and I said, yeah, the demons are going to be on the playground, but they're going to get tired and I'm going to beat their ass one day. I don't know when, but they're going to get tired of poking their little heads up and coming out of the playground, because they're going to see the army that I have. And that's what I've done, is I've kind of built this army around me. So when the demons are on the playground, my warriors are coming on the playground too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of that whole mentality of, you know, when I first got smoked with the, you have PTS, anxiety and depression, this is the end all be all. You know, and I've had numerous people, oh, it's fake, it can't be real.
Oh, God.
It is. You know, and
so can I ask you, who, like, was it leadership, or was it just friends who weren't fire service people or EMTs, or who was telling you it's not real?
So it's some people that one of them kind of has a leadership role, but others were just like street techs, just like, you know, myself. Hmm. You know, and, oh, you can't have this. You haven't been in for 20 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's my story. You know, and here's why I have it. And here's what I did.
Right.
You know, so after my arm blew out, I was like, well, shit, what do I do now? You know, and I reverted back to Heidi's accident, you know, and the determination and the drive with everybody, you know, the fire department, the paramedics, the flight crew, you know, the hospital staff, you know, and I saw that resiliency and I'm like, I am that resilient.
Yeah.
So I, like you said, just never give up, because you can't quit. There's no quit in my bones.
Yeah.
And so I got my bachelor's degree in kinesiology. And wow. I was like, oh,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yep. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go be a physical therapist. And I was like, nope. Like, cause I don't want to do that. Like I want to be a firefighter paramedic. Like, and none of my family has ever worked in firefighter world or paramedic world or EMS or anything like that. You know, my mom worked for the court system and my dad he was a higher up at Spirit Aero Systems. So yeah. It's all been like a business, you know, and so I was geared in a business world. And I told my mom, I said, hey, you know, cause my mom was my best friend of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I grew up, the most two important women in my life were my mom and my grandma. Wow. And it didn't matter where they were, you know, or where I was playing. They were there, you know, they've seen me pitch in Mississippi and Alabama and Texas and Colorado and everywhere. And, so when I told my mom, I was like, I'm going to go be a paramedic and firefighter. And she's like, what? I was like, yeah. I was like, why not? I get to help you.
And why? Cause I'm going to worry about you.
Yeah. She's like, why would you do that? And I was like, mom, I get to help people. I was like, I help kids, you know, cause I was starting to coach. I was like, I help kids now, you know, get better in baseball. Why can't I help people when they're sick?
Right.
I was like, look at what they did for Heidi. So when I made it that personal with my mom, she told me, she's like, go be the best damn paramedic you can be.
Wow.
Like, okay. So I went to EMT school. I started working at Butler County with the reserve portion of it just to get my feet wet and get some experience and make sure that this is what I wanted. So I'm like, yep, this is it. So I got on with the fire department and I started going there and I applied for paramedic school and I got in. Mm-hmm. And I started in August. Yeah, I started in August. And then it all, like, the events started taking place. So I started the fire department in September, on September 10th. And September 10th, 2013, actually. And my daughter, she was 3 months old. My daughter's got blonde hair, blue eyes. And she was just this little chubby little baby. But I'll get back to why, you know, this kind of pertains to everything. So, September 10th of 2013 at, you know, 9:04 in the morning, we get toned out for a pediatric cardiac arrest. So this was my first day.
Really important that it was your first day, just for the audience, and I'll tell them why at the end. But yeah, first day, so, peed call.
So we arrive on scene, and my paramedic partner, he runs up, grabs the baby, we put her in the back of the truck, and we literally haul ass to the hospital, because we have this six-month-old infant baby that's not breathing and does not have a heartbeat.
Oh, God.
And we could not save her. And I didn't think that was going to be detrimental, but I still, to this day, have the safety glasses stained with tears because all I could see was my little Callie Rose. Oh, and that's my daughter's name, is Callie. So we got sent home from shift and I was okay. Like, you know, cause I got to see my little girl and I got to see my oldest son and I got to see my wife and everything was okay.
Mm-hmm. You thought.
Little did I know as I put that in Little did I know is I put that in the back of my storage box and just left it there.
Yeah.
Well, then I got hired on at Butler County EMS. And it was October 21st of 2013. And this day is forever ingrained in me. My dad calls me at 12:01 in the morning. And if you call me at night when I'm sleeping, my phone could be right next to my head and I'm out. I will not hear it.
Okay.
And I picked it up on the first ring. I don't know why, because I was dead asleep. And I answered it. My dad told me that I had to get to the house right now. So I lived about 3 miles away. So it was at 12:01. I was in a dead sleep. And I don't know why everything is just engraved in my head and why it's so freaking timestamped. Because I'd never looked at a clock. Not one time did I look at a clock.
Yeah.
I got in my truck and I literally hauled ass to my parents' house. And George Strait was playing. And I got to my, and it was Amarillo by morning, by the way. But I got to my parents' house, and it's from their front door to my mom and dad's bathroom is 19 steps. And that's where I found my mom collapsed by the toilet.
Oh no.
And I just had dinner with her that previous night. And everything seemed fine. You know, my mom had some health issues and all that, but she seemed fine. Like everything was okay. And I get to her at 12:04 in the morning and she's not talking to me. Like she's mumbling and like, uh-oh, I can't make sense of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck is happening to my mom? Like, and now I go from son to I'm a paramedic student. Don't miss anything. Start, yeah, go to work, like clock in and go to work, you know, because I have to save my mom. Like if it's any other fucking call out there, I don't give two shits. This is the one that matters because it's my mom. It's my best friend. It's the one who gave me life. Right. It's the one, my everything. And we ended up calling EMS because I was off shift. We ended up calling them. They came and I was in the back of the truck with my mom on the way to the hospital. And she did not say a word to me. She just held my hand. So we get to the hospital.
But was she conscious? Was she looking at you?
She was not.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay.
She never looked at me. So, we get her to the hospital and they come back and they tell me, and I'm not trying to like cry or choke up or anything. So I really have to like catch my breath.
It's okay to choke up on this podcast. That's what we're trying to get people to see. Right? It's, yeah.
So they tell me that the outlook is not good and to prepare for her to pass away. And that was the very first time I've ever heard my dad say that my mom has a DNR or a do not resuscitate order.
Oh no. You didn't know that.
I had no clue.
Oh man.
And I immediately got pissed at my dad, like very, very pissed. Never hatred pissed, but close, because that's my best friend that's laying there.
Yeah.
So they came and transferred her out, from one hospital to a higher level hospital. And the crew that came and got her just gave me the biggest hug in the world. They knew what was up. I did not, because it was my mom and I was so blinded. So they left and I had internship the next day at 6 a.m. So I told my dad and my brother that we have to swing by the house and I have to get my books and we'll make a pot of coffee. And so I made a pot of coffee and I waited for that pot of coffee to finish before we left.
Mm-hmm.
I got to the hospital at 5:04 or 5:05.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom passed away at 5:04.
Oh, so, that gave me chills. Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was like, that shattered everything. So I literally, the last thing that I remember of my mom was in the back of the ambulance holding my hand.
So what happened to the pot of coffee? I mean,
I waited for it to end. So my dad, my brother, and myself could get coffee.
But I mean, I think maybe you mentioned this. Yeah, there's something about the pot of coffee.
So to this day, and it's, it's what, June 18th, 2021. That happened October 21st of 2013, and I've never waited for another pot of coffee to finish because I can't, because it's 5:05. Like the top of that pot of coffee is 5:05.
And so I think that speaks to the unique stress. I mean, I believe that first responder stress is qualitatively different from other kinds of stress. I don't have the studies. I don't know off the top of my head if there are any, but there is something about having the pressure of being the person who can save people that creates it. It's got to be an impossible expectation. Like you just waited for the coffee to finish. And, but there's also that it's the stuff that haunts you guys, right? Like I've heard over and over again about, if I'd only done this, if I'd done that, why did I make that call? If I'd stopped it's the what ifs. And it's the what ifs in your bunk alone. It's not the what ifs when you're talking. So I have a story and that, I would love to just invite you and everybody else out there who has these things. We are all human. Even you guys are human, which is what you're trying to get out there. And we all make the best decisions we can with the information we have in the moment. And there does seem to be something about sort of the first responder personality that just can't accept that they can't go back and redo it? Is that kind of right? Like it just haunts you guys.
It's not a test. You can't retake it.
Yeah. So that's part of that qualitative difference in the stress too, is like there's no practice runs with this stuff. And you never know what you're walking into. And it could have been a done deal. The person's not gonna live no matter what you did. But there's somehow this, but I can do it. I can help them, I can save them. And then
So my mom was like the best person in the world. So I have it tattooed on my leg as a constant reminder. It's on my leg because she was my foundation. Wow. And that's why it's there.
Yeah.
And my dad, my dad played a ton of different roles in my life as well. And he was a great dad. But I just grew up a mama's boy.
You know what? Can you say that again? I love that. I mean, it's about damn time that, that wasn't a derogatory thing, because the science behind it shows that boys who are really healthily and very bonded with their moms are happier, healthier, better husbands, better fathers. And thank you, you big 6 foot tall, like hero dude. Like just, yes, right? Thank you.
my two boys, my oldest, he's 14 and he's going through those weird ass teenager phases.
Right.
But he's a mama's boy. My 2-year-old, my wife just now got home from work and, he was glued to my side that first podcast. Now, mama's home. So we don't need dad now.
Yeah.
And so that's the good thing, and.
Well, and that you both play roles. Like you play your role and she plays hers, but that's just been such a derogatory thing. But anyway, I jumped in. Go ahead.
Oh no, you're good.
I love it.
I was in paramedic school at that time. I was a certified EMT. So my mom died on a Thursday. And I tried to go to class Tuesday. Or no, my mom died on a Monday. Sorry. She died Monday. I tried to go to class on Tuesday just for a sense of normalcy. Because after somebody passes away, you got a shit ton of people at your house. And you got a shit ton of people saying, I'm sorry, if you ever need anything, let me know. That's a statement full of bullshit if I haven't heard a statement of bullshit before.
Everybody's there until they all go away at about week 3, and then you're totally alone with all the grief.
Right? Yeah, until I need something.
Right,
Let me process what, my whole world is just literally ripped in half.
Yeah.
Let me process this. So I tried to go to class, and they started talking about, all the stuff that my mom had, and I got up and I walked out. And my entire class walked out with me and I literally just started crumbling and they were right there.
Yeah.
And so I knew I'd made the right decision of going to be a paramedic.
Wow.
So I ended up dropping out of paramedic class and I told the lead instructor, I said, I'm done. I don't want to do this. I'm never going to do it. Like, this is too hard. Mm-hmm. Well, they said, we're not taking no for an answer.
Nope.
You're going to be in the next class and you're going to graduate. And I was like, why do you have faith in me? Chris Cannon told me, and he's the head guy of Cali College for the paramedic program. He told me, he's like, Mike, we see a great paramedic in you. We just have to get you through these hurdles.
Yeah.
So they literally came and kidnapped me and took me to the first day of my first day of paramedic school.
Wow.
That's when I graduated, everyone was, just as in shock, like I did it, like I passed it, and I revert back to getting my professional contract. And I'm like, I did it, but I didn't have my mom there to celebrate with me. Yes, I had my wife and my aunt, which my aunt and my mom were super close. Mm-hmm. And she was there, and my son ended up giving me a challenge coin, that every graduating paramedic gets from Cali. Mm-hmm. And it was just so surreal. Like I did one thing, like this huge monstrous task without my mom. And I didn't have no clue how I did it, but she was there.
I was going to say in you. She's part of you, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So she made me the paramedic that I am. So then kind of leading up to my diagnosis, it was October 1st of 2021 or 2020. Sorry. I was training a paramedic student, and this paramedic student is very special to me. not only because he was my very first paramedic student that I'm training and, you know, doing all that, we just clicked. You know, he liked the Chicago White Sox, which that's the only thing that was, well, more than the only thing that was wrong with him. But I'm a Chicago Cubs fan.
Right.
He was a Chicago Bears fan, and I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. So we argued back and forth, and it was football season. But anyway, so it was October 1st of 2020 at, you know, 9-something in the morning. We get called to a pediatric cardiac arrest. And we go in there, and I can still tell you, you know, the color, you know, what was on his diaper and the house and everything.
Right.
Because I've been blessed and cursed with a photographic memory.
Okay.
So, and we can jump on that, you know, after a bit. From the time of the call, from the time I cleared the hospital was 14 minutes.
Oh,
and
wow.
I never got a pulse back on this baby.
Aww.
But we're sitting there and I was like, you know what? We've been on scene for far too long. We are getting the fuck out of here. So as I'm carrying this baby, doing compressions on it, I see his mom. Well, I played baseball with her brother.
The baby's mom?
The baby's mom.
Oh, my.
I played baseball with the baby's mom's brother. So we all grew up as a baseball family. And it's kind of weird how everything ties into baseball with me. And so I took the baby to the hospital. And I left the room, you know, just a huge amount of failure, you know, on my feelings wise. And when I walked out, she's like, Mike, and she gave me the biggest hug. She's like, I'm glad it was you.
Oh.
Because we had the best.
Oh my gosh.
And I told her, I said, don't give up. I was like, cause we're going to get him back. Like, right. I'm going to get my face sheet. I'm going to go back there and right. we're going to do it.
Right.
Like, we're going to get him back. And so he ended up passing away, but they found a bunch of other stuff that was wrong with him.
Well, you never got a pulse back from him, you know? So that's kind of just for you and other, you know, first responders who are listening, there's that unreal. I mean, you guys put such expectations and demands on yourself. He didn't have a pulse.
No, absolutely.
You never got a pulse. Right. And so, but you still felt like a failure. And if there's anything, like, if I could figure out a curriculum or a training to kind of help you guys through that, that's devastating that you're holding yourself responsible for something that was already a done deal. Like the pulse never came.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We can't, and I'm not very religious or anything, but God has a plan. You know, and when it's your time, it's your time, you know, and we go and we try to interrupt that time and to buy you more time.
Right. Can I tell you a story? I think this dovetails and obviously, I can't talk about who told me this story. It's confidential, but I had a client, guy contact me, client, and this is, I think, hopefully it'll help people understand the degree to which your physical body takes over and starts to protect you once you've had trauma, and that your mind, your brain, you don't have control over it. Like your subconscious mind and your body just take over. So for anybody out there who's a partner or a spouse of someone who's had trauma, not just first responders, but anyone who's had trauma, who are having post-trauma symptoms, a lot of the times it's more confusing to us than it is to you. Like we just don't even we don't even know what's happening and we don't understand, right? Until we start doing specific work on it. But this this guy had, and I also, before we go today, Mike, I want to talk about, you know, kid calls, because there's, you know, you've mentioned them a couple times and this is a kid call too, and they're so important. So this guy was called out to a kid not breathing. I think he was 7. His daughter was the same age again, which that just messes with your mind. There's just no two ways about it, right? And to be faced with watching other kids your kid's age go through stuff or pass away is terrifying at a level that I don't even think most people can deal with. Or they you know, your mind just doesn't even put it out there for you.
Right.
Basically went in, cleared the airway, intubated the kid, went on to the hospital, you know, did the whatever work, paperwork or whatever. And before he left, this very kind ER doc came out and said, "Didn't you see the grape?" And the reason why I was having conversations with this person is because he was having problems with choking and breathing, like 19 years later. I don't remember exactly the year, but decades later. And yep. He was going to medical doctors and medical doctors and medical doctors. They were like, you know, just going to take off his uvula. And, you know, he had all these procedures and whatever, and lots of drugs and benzodiazepines. And he, you know, it's not my job to tell him anything. You know, we talked and I listened. And finally one day he said, I think that my inability, my choking and my, you know, he would be driving and he said he would just driving his truck and his chin would just go down to his chest and he couldn't get it up and he couldn't breathe. And he'd have to take his hand and push his chin up. So our bodies and minds do incredible things to help us try to deal with stuff that our minds aren't ready to deal with because they're in comp, we just can't, they're way too much to understand. So basically, you know what happened, you know, the grape went, right? And he had not been able to accept that for lots of reasons, right? And I remember saying, you know, you do understand that you could not know it was there and that you did exactly what you were trained to do. And he's like, yeah, but, and I'm like, no, like, no, but, like, that's, like you said, sometimes it's just the way it is, but,
right.
But man, what you guys go through. And I say that as an example, kind of like what you were talking about is, it's so complex, you know, and the fact that, you know, there are kids at home with you, we can hear them and you have a lot going on, right? And it's not like you guys just put on this uniform and become this, except now you say you have to be like robots. You can't be a robot. And those of us who kind of think we want you to be a robot, yeah, we don't. Think again, because we need you. Yeah.
After we cleared that call, you know, my captain was with me and my partner and paramedic student were in the back of the truck, and she looked at me, she asked me if I was okay. And you know, I just literally started bursting into tears, you know, because I have a little baby boy at the house and all that. And so it was a staff meeting day, so everybody was there. So they called me up to the front to ask, you know, they presented me with an award and they wanted me to talk about it. And I couldn't talk about it because I just ran this little kid. Jeez. But so that's kind of what set my boss off to like check on me was I text him at 3 o'clock in the morning and he calls me. I was like, hey, we did this, we did that. And he asked me why I wasn't sleeping. I was like, cause I'm running through this call. Right. And we go over it. And he's like, Mike, he had like a 3.5 centimeter cyst on his esophagus that we didn't know about.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know that.
No.
And so I'm sitting there and I'm like literally beating myself up over this and I'm not sleeping. And I turned to the beer fridge just so I could hopefully pass out. And it wouldn't work. You know, so I got into a deep, dark spot. And, you know, that's kind of what pushed me over the edge. And, you know, with all the other traumatic calls that we've ran and all the other traumatic stuff that we've seen.
Right.
You know, and it was just, how do I get back to being a normal dude that my wife knows, that my kids know, that my friends know?
Right.
Not necessarily my coworkers, because they see me as paramedic Mike.
Right.
You know, my wife and my kids, they see me as husband Mike or dad Mike. You know, my friends, they see me as Mike, you know, and not this broken, shattered dude that feels a bunch of stress and, you know, just that feeling of letting people down.
Yeah, but you know what, dude, there's one thing you're not, as broken and shattered. And,
right.
You know, I'm learning so much from you. So what I'm realizing, so I was just focusing on the juxtaposition between why you were okay with a shattered elbow and not being able to play baseball, but why you weren't okay with, you know, having injury from your job, right? But
right.
You just told me that there's a lot of steps in between. And I want to kind of jump on that just for a second. And I know you probably have to go because you've got a lake to get to and kids to, you know, get out of here. But there are those steps, and I think those are super important. So basically, and I know it's not just you. We try to cope and to deal and to kind of get back to that person. You just said that, and it's not just you. It's all of us. And when it comes to reaching for things to to sleep. And so first of all, sleep is just, it just goes first, right? Like sleep and oftentimes sex, like you're so stressed out and you're in your head and you're running through scenarios and calls and, you know, all that stuff, that those things go. But then you have to sleep because you have to perform and you have to work and you have to make these critical decisions. So you realize that you're not able to think well because you're not sleeping. So what do you do? Well, you know, alcohol often helps you to sleep. We now know that it ruins your sleep after you've been asleep for a while. But the problem with alcohol and other drugs is that they work for the short term. They work at first, right?
The short term.
So we kind of get lulled into this. Okay, so if I just have a you know, glass of wine and whatever before dinner, or a beer or two or whatever, then I'm still managing. I'm not going to lose my job. I'm keep, you know, the whatever, and I'm dealing at home and my wife's happy. And but then that takes its toll too. And eventually that resilience is just sort of like blanketed or suffocated or something. But yeah. So I do. I think it's really about like how do we prevent and get people talking about it ahead of time. The other thing I wanted to point out, and I know you and I talked about this before, though, is that we now know that talking about it isn't always the right thing to do. And it's about the timing of talking about it. So if somebody is in a, we call it an over-aroused state, so up into fight flight, and they're trying to talk about it, they can actually re-traumatize their brain. So we often, the way I figured that out is because I had lots of first responders tell me that, you know, they want me to talk about it, but I'm not there yet. I'm not ready, or I can't, or I don't want to. And nobody was listening to you folks. Like, okay, let's talk later then, right? But the instinct was there because their brain was saying, not now. And you guys are often forced to talk. Like especially if there's a bad outcome and there's a legal thing going on, like you have to debrief.
Yep.
And yeah, it's just bad.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where it was, why do I have to talk on their terms? You know, and that was the biggest thing.
Right.
No, talk on my terms. Because now you're going to get the real answer. And it's not going to be sugar-coated. It's not going to be covered. It's going to be uncut and it's going to be raw. Because my goal is to help others like me.
Right.
Because I know I'm not the only one out there.
I know
that I'm not the only one that runs the shit calls, you know, for lack of better words, that's what we call them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. There's other people out there that are too scared to come forward because they're afraid they're going to get fired.
Right.
Well, I'm still employed. I worked yesterday and I'm going to work on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and my boss has zero questions.
And you're killing it, right? Like you were at the top of your game.
Absolutely. And that's what he told me. He's like, Mike, I've been on numerous calls with you, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be my boss or my captain. They're like, we've been on numerous calls with you and we see how you operate. And we mm-hmm. see that you're just getting it. Everything's clicking and all that.
Right.
And
so, well, I firmly believe that people who have had trauma can, it's called post-traumatic growth, and there's a way to work through it. I truly believe that people who've had trauma, you can actually use, once you process and kind of begin to recover from it, you get to a point where it becomes a strength for you. Like, for instance, I had people who, my ex-husband was an abuser. And so now, even though I had to go through the sort of the fight flight and the hyper, you know, resilient, or the hyper arousal and jumpiness and all that stuff, and I'm still jumpy, but I can read people like a book because I learned how to read him to keep myself and my kids alive, right? So that's another point that you're bringing up that is really a hopeful thing for people who are in that sort of dark time when you're just coming out and it's just like there's no light anywhere, right? But that we not only get through it, we get stronger and better, and then we can use the things that hurt us to make us stronger, help us, and then they can help other people too. And you just demonstrated that, right?
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing, you know, is like, yeah, we can get our message out there and we can do all that, but if you're going to spread the awareness and the just bring it out, there's got to be a plan. You know, there's got to be a plan to correct it. And that's what we're working on is, you know, my steps are to let the service directors know or the fire chiefs know that, yes, I have this, but it doesn't affect my job. You know, don't pull me off the box, or don't pull me off the engine, mm-hmm. or the ladder, or the squad. I'm okay. I just have this.
We talked about that before we started recording, right? So let me just go back through it. And so you have your position, I have my position, and let's see if we can help, like, come to a mutual thing or not. It doesn't really matter. But my thing is that it can, though. You know, there are people who have PTSI who would absolutely affects their performance because it reduces their cognition, their ability to think. And so there is. But what I also believe is if you're there, if you get the proper support, like your boss gave you, the ability to work through it in a natural way without a lot of medications, right? Or alcohol or other numbing things, and you don't have to be like all the way through it. I mean, you could still have symptoms, but there is a self-mastery. And I've worked with tons of people who have done it, and I've done it myself, where you recognize it, you know it's coming on, you know that you're either going into fight flight or you're going into collapse, right? Where you're numb and you're floaty. And there's techniques like jumping jacks. And also if you're on the other end of the spectrum, if your sympathetic nervous system is offline and you're numb, you literally, there's a technique that you slap yourself and you literally wake your body back up. So it's not that we get over it, but we learn how to manage it and then go back to our job that we love, right?
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Super, super cool. I think your family has been really patient, and I can hear everybody needs you. And I'm going to get off the phone, even if we can do this another time again. But please thank your wife and your kids. I've taken up a ton of your time, and I really appreciate it. And I'm really looking forward to working with you. I really am.
I think we can do a lot of good things. And
me too. Yeah, me too.
It gives me motivation and really inspires me to know that somebody that's not in EMS has just massive amounts of passion to save us.
Well, you guys save yourselves. If I can do something, I hope I can. But you know, it's incredible what you guys do, and I think that if I can just add the science to what you guys already are doing, then that could be my little part. Because, you know, you guys got this. You just need somebody not to pull against you. Like, you need people to not throw bricks at your rigs and, you know, fire you because you went through a stressful time that the job created. I mean, yeah, if you could just get a little bit of a break, I think y'all would be fine. But
absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, have fun and thank you. Please thank your wife for me, and we'll hopefully talk pretty soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
And that was Mike Lewis in the second of a 2-episode podcast. Thank you again, Mike, for being so open about your struggle and honest about what you've gone through. I think you're helping a lot of people who suffer from PTSI, including just everyday folks like myself. And I still love your boss.
Thank you for listening to the Traumatic States of America. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Lori Hood, go to LoriHoodPhD.com. The Traumatic States of America podcast is produced and engineered by Bernd Ahle Productions at their studio in Washington, D.C.